Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, director Todd Phillips. I'm bringing the anti-hero to end all anti-heroes back in Joker, Folies à Deux. A very unusual documentary called Call Me Mule, about a man wandering America's West for over 30 years with three mules. And Chris Wasser has all the reviews of the week's new movies. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. This will be a budget free zone. You have heard lots of that by very intelligent people all week long, but this will be a budget free zone. You will perhaps be pleased to hear it. Or maybe you're dying for me to talk about bottom lines and debt to equity ratios. But alas, I can't. However, I will quickly tell you that in our house, the big news this week was we got a cat. We finally gave in to a pet. So my children, we weren't ready for a dog. So we got a cat from a rescue who we've christened Pudsley. Yes, Pudsley Fardy. What you make of that, folks? Quite fitting, I think. And but there's a lot of minding in a cat. I hadn't realized. Now, I know people who have pets are going, is this guy for real? Like, what did you think? Well, I'll tell you what I thought. I thought it'd be like a child in the 80s. You let them out in the morning and they come back in the evening when they're hungry. But it's not like that. It's litter boxes. It's food. It's looking for them at night because you're afraid they've run away. So, but anyway, he's worth it, I guess, little Pudsley. So anyway, that was happening in my world. Now, away from the minutiae of my life, we get to movies and TV and all that stuff that we do on this show. And the big movie event of the week is unquestionably this.
When I saw you and Murray Franklin, the whole time I was watching, I kept thinking, I hope this guy blows his brains out. And then you did. And for once in my life, I didn't feel so alone anymore. Forget your troubles, come on, get happy. Better chase all your cares away. Sing hallelujah, come on, get happy.
Yes, now that is Lady Gaga, or Lady Gaga, as certain American people seem to call her, opposite the great Joaquin Phoenix. And Lady Gaga is great in all things, and particularly in this, the new Joker movie, which is intriguingly is called Joker Folies à Deux. It's part two. It's the follow-up to the Academy Award-winning Joker from 2019, which earned $1 billion at the box office and was really, you know, wasn't a superhero movie at all. There was a small allusion to Bruce Wayne, but it was Joaquin Phoenix playing Arthur Fleck, who takes on this Joker character to pretty horrific consequences in the end. I thought the first Joker movie was fantastic. Hard to watch in some ways, but that's often the sign of a good movie. Now, the second one, Joker Folies à Deux, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 4th of October, finds Arthur Fleck now institutionalized at Arkham, awaiting trial for his crimes. And while he's continuing to struggle with this dual identity of Arthur and Joker, what happens is he stumbles upon, well, I guess true love in the form of Harley Quinn, Lady Gaga, who he meets kind of in a musical group in this insane asylum, Arkham, which Batman fan knows is the place where baddies who have mental health issues go, and that's putting it mildly. And they fall in love, and they fall in love over music. And this is, in essence, a musical. There are a lot of singing numbers in it with Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga singing to each other and about their lives. And Harley Quinn is a devotee of Joker. And then we have Joker, Arthur Fleck, on trial. And a large part of it takes place in a courtroom. And this is, again, dividing critics. I've seen 4-star reviews. I've seen 2-star reviews. I think it's really good in that it's continuing the vein of this is not a superhero movie, and it's a musical prison courtroom drama with a tremendous pair of leads in the form of Joaquin Phoenix with that crazy laugh and Lady Gaga. So I think it really works. The criticism people are making is that maybe the plot is a little thin and that not a huge amount happens, but I think it's a very entertaining investigation of this strange mind, this pair of strange minds, and this love affair between Harley Quinn and Joker. And the musical numbers are great in it. Lady Gaga probably has the better singing voice. Well, that's no surprise there, really. It was directed, and sorry, I should say, Brendan Gleeson shows up as a prison guard in it, and he's very good. It was directed by Todd Phillips, who gave us the first one, who gave us one of the best. I mean, not all the Hangover movies are as successful as the first one, but the first Hangover movie, and I do enjoy them all, but the first Hangover movie is one of the best comedies of the last 25 years. A genuine belly laugh. He's given us Due Date. He famously said in the past that he moved away from comedies to make Joker because he felt he couldn't make comedies anymore because there was just this army of people ready to complain to him on Twitter and other social media platforms about you can't make these jokes. So he stopped and he made two Joker movies. So I spoke to director Todd Phillips about his new Joker movie and a bit more besides.
Nice to meet you.
Tell me this, you know, I was very taken. I heard you once say the first time around with Joker, there was people going, how are we going to sell Joker pajamas based on this? It occurs to me, you've pushed it even further this time. We have Lady Gaga singing opposite the Joker. It's a courtroom drama. It's not to give any spoilers. It's a prison drama. I mean, was part of your motivation in the storytelling not that you were trying to get away from selling pajamas, but just to see how far you could move this thing?
Well, no. I mean, it wasn't. No, that wasn't a motivation. It was to see how few pajamas we could sell. It was more... It was really more logically where the story took us as writers to start with. I swear, it wasn't like, ooh, let's see what we can get away with. I swear, but
yeah, no, I did. You know, I mentioned Lady Gaga and Joaquin. I keep reading about these things in Hollywood now, chemistry tests, and I don't know whether or not they did one, but by God, they have chemistry. And I mean, to put someone opposite Arthur Flack, It's no easy feat because he's such a complicated character. Did it work straight away with them, or was there a lot of you do this, you do that?
That's a really good question. It's definitely a process. It's not like first of all, I mean, she's coming into a world that's already existed before she got there because there's a whole nother movie. So that's so daunting for her as an actress. Equally daunting for him as an actor is that he has to now sing in front of her. So that can't be easy. So they were both uneasy about two different things. And so the chemistry, half the reason why you start these conversations months before you start shooting is to get all that tension and weirdness out. So when you are filming, hopefully that chemistry has been established and exists. But I wouldn't say it was there, instantly on the first meeting at my house or something. It was more developed.
Yeah, sure. You know, Arthur Fleck, in the first one, you have this strange situation where you feel sympathy for him, even though he's in the process of doing horrible things.
Right.
And even more so in this one. And you find, people talk about anti-heroes. It seems to me this guy is the biggest anti-hero I've seen in a long time. Is that part of your motivation in this character? That, yes, he's doing awful things, the worst thing imaginable. And yet at times, you're so sympathetic to him. Like, you play us like an accordion. So mission accomplished, I guess. Is that the mission in some fashion?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's to look at him through an empathetic lens, so to speak, certainly in the first movie. And then in this continuing that, it's not to justify the things that he did in the first film, but it's to give an understanding of where they may have come from. And we continue that in this, but I think it really speaks what you're talking about to Joaquin's power as an actor, because I don't know that every actor would get people on his side
the way
they were in the first film and hopefully in this.
Mm. If I knew nothing about the history of this movie, when I saw this on Monday morning, I couldn't help but think there's some parallel between a very famous New York resident. There's a guy sitting in court doing and saying awful things at times and kind of lying, and there's a crowd of people cheering him. I'm sure I'm not the first person to possibly reel or intention that there is some parallel between him and a former president. Was that in your thinking, or was it a happy or an unhappy accident?
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't put it on just him, but this idea, at least in the in the States, that sometimes we elect characters and not people, meaning sometimes a lot of people are playing a part in life. I'm not just politicians, but in general.
All of us, possibly.
Well, to some extent, but some of it is, I mean, in our, you know, you're referring to Donald Trump, of course, and I always think about it my own as that might be the first time we elected a character as the president, not a person, meaning it's like a professional wrestler. He was playing a character. And yes, I think there's some similarities to Arthur and his sort of Joker, where he's putting on a character because for whatever reason, you know, that Arthur does it, for whatever reason Donald does it. But yeah, I would say there is similarities for sure.
Yeah. You know, I bore people sometimes. I spoke to Kevin Bacon a couple of weeks ago, and I brought up Billy Joel because I claim to be Ireland's biggest Billy Joel fan. You might wonder where I'm going about this, but one of my favorite comedies ever is The Hangover and the whole series of them. And I'm just wondering, Alan is a Billy Joel fan. And at one point, there's a picture of glass houses. And before I knew who you were, I remember thinking, you know, Alan's kind of the slightly laughable character in this movie. Is this director taking the PISS out of Billy Joel? But then I've read about it. You're not. You're a big fan as well.
Huge,
right?
Huge. I mean, what a singer songwriter. I love him. And Downeaster Alexa is one of my favorite songs of all time. We weren't taking. Alan just happened to love Billy Joel like you.
Let's not get into the similarities between me and him. You know, you famously said, we don't have to rehash all this again, but, you know, it was very hard to keep making comedies in the world we live in. And I'm paraphrasing, but when there's 20 million people on Twitter ready to take you down for making a joke, it's hard. And you wanted to stop that for a while. But I watch a lot of movies, and I mentioned I love The Hangover. I haven't seen a great comedy in a long time. I really haven't. I could tell you what the last one was and we could get into a discussion about that. But the world needs comedies. Are you tempted to make another one?
No, I agree with you. And when I said that, I mean, I did say that, but it was part of a much larger conversation because, of course, people were still doing stand-up has never gone away. There's some of the funniest stand-up in the last 5 years has still happened. I was specifically talking about movies for theaters and you know, audiences' response the way we're used to, you and I talking about the comedies from 15 years ago. Yeah. And they would play like rock concerts with 500 people in the crowd. Yes, I agree with you. I think the world needs comedy now more than ever, and I talk about it all the time with the people I work with about getting back and doing something just wild.
Right. Well, we look forward to that. But in the meantime, I'll urge people to go and see your new film. It's lovely to talk to you, Todd. Thanks.
You as well. Nice to meet you.
Todd Phillips there talking to me about Joker and returning to comedies possibly in the future. And of course, Billy Joel, which I always bring up whenever there's any possible connection. And he was talking to me, though, ostensibly about Joker, Folie à Deux, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 4th of October. Interesting guy. And he's going to make a comedy again, it seems. And I did bring up Billy Joel to him because the Alan character in The Hangover is a big Billy Joel fan. And incidentally, I'm going on a slight tangent here. You may possibly have seen during the week that Billy Joel announced two gigs in Scotland and one in Anfield in Liverpool. Hard for me to go to Anfield for certain reasons. But I was thinking of going and maybe even going with my whole family because, you know, they've heard a lot of Billy Joel, God bless them, in our house, and all of us going, the five of us. Gotta say, I looked yesterday at the ticket prices and you know, I'm a massive Billy Joel fan, but by God, you know, I think it's time to call a halt to this ticket thing. I don't want to rehash the whole Oasis thing and all, but, you know, there are only a few acts in the world who can play stadiums, you know, like Bruce or Billy or Coldplay or U2 or Metallica or the Foo Fighters. Like that idea of, you know, playing to 80,000 people, that's because of the spotification of music and all sorts of reasons, that's probably a dying art, but it's one of the great joys in life, or certainly in my life, to be in those big arenas with a band or a singer. But, you know, with these ticket prices, they might be shooting themselves in their foot, because I think there's a sea change coming where people are going to go, you know, I'm not sure about this. This is too much money to pay. And you know, as I've told you, I'm a massive Billy Joel fan, but even I am starting to balk at these ticket prices. So let's see what happens there. So as things stand, I'm not going to go see Billy Joel in London, or in Liverpool, I should say, next year. But if you are going to the cinema this weekend, I think it would be well worth your while going to see Joker. There's no Batman and Robin in it, and there's a lot of musical numbers, but I found it an intriguing watch. Up next, we will be reviewing it some more and the week's other new movie releases in the company of Chris Wasser. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and movie show. We turn now to the week's other new cinema releases, but we will also be briefly returning to Joker, we are going to be looking at a time-traveling movie called Things Will Be Different, as well as an intriguing new movie called A Different Man. I'm profoundly and sincerely delighted now to be joined by arts critic and film journalist Chris Wasser. Chris, you're profoundly and sincerely welcome to the show.
John, that's the nicest introduction you've given me. How are you?
And I've given you some good ones.
You have.
So, yeah, let's see what happens next. But anyway, to slightly more mundane matters, A Different Man, an unusual movie in some sense, starring Sebastian Stan, very different than a Marvel vehicle, though.
It is very different for Sebastian Stan, but I actually think he's doing better than an awful lot of the actors in that Marvel family. You know, when he's not starring as Bucky, the Winter Soldier, in the never-ending Avengers saga, he's picking the roles that, you know, and I suppose an actor who appears in, you know, multi-million dollar blockbusters and earns big paychecks from that, they have the luxury then of going off and doing some of the quirkier stuff in their spare time. But if this is his spare time work, I mean, he's doing pretty well. You know, he's kind of leaning towards these tricky, eccentric productions. He's turning into a very interesting character actor. I am all here for the Sebastian Stan character actor phase. And here, this is probably his most effective role and probably one of his best films. He's playing a man named Edward, who is this lonely New Yorker who suffers from something called neurofibromatosis, which is a genetic skin condition that causes facial deformities. And he is also an actor, but he's an actor without a plan, without much of a CV, and without much luck. You know, he doesn't really get that many jobs either on screen or on stage, and he sort of gets by on these, you know, dodgy, cheesy appearances in these creaky public service advertising films. So he's sort of the star of these, you know, ads that are shown in workplaces saying, you know, if someone looks different to you, still treat them with kindness, you know, very kind of condescending and patronizing towards people that might have, you know, a condition like he does. But still, it is paying the bills, but he would like more work, and he'd also like more friendships and maybe even a girlfriend. And he kind of has this, he's smitten by this new neighbor at his, you know, rundown New York apartment building. His neighbor's named Ingrid. She's played by Renée Renisvay. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. And she's this aspiring playwright who's kind of short on ideas, but she also develops a friendship with him. So you can kind of see where that might go. So Edward is kind of thinking to himself, I would love a relationship with this person, and I would love my life to be happier. So when a doctor comes along and says that he has this experimental procedure that promises to, quote, cure his face, he decides to take it. It's a very tricky, one of those kind of miracle drug procedures, John, that you see in films where it's like, don't ask too many questions. You know, yeah. He just goes into the hospital for the day and comes out.
The science may not be sound, in other words.
That's it, exactly, yeah. But we start to see, and there are some kind of interesting body horror elements at play for just a few minutes, mind, because this is mostly a black comedy. But he wakes up the next morning, And he has this, you know, again, quote unquote, normal face. He looks like Sebastian Stan. So he decides to reinvent his life. And I know this is a long synopsis, so I'll end here. Basically, he develops this new life for himself as a successful real estate agent. And he literally has his face on billboards. You know, his face is out there for the first time in his life. But what he doesn't expect to happen is for Ingrid to go off and write a play off Broadway based on his life. And he wants to be in that play. He thinks, you know, if anyone is going to perform, you know, me, it should be me. But he doesn't expect competition to arrive in the form of a man named Oswald, who's played by Adam Pearson, who in real life has that condition. So a very odd rivalry there ensues.
I haven't seen this, but from the trailer, he becomes somewhat obsessed with Adam Pearson's character.
He does, yeah. And if it sounds as though I gave too much away there, that's the basic setup.
Yeah.
There's another, you know, this is a two-hour film, so there's an awful lot going on in there. And it's very playful when it comes to this idea of, you know, this guy who just, you know, doesn't have a friend in the world, doesn't really have a hope, and he thinks that if he can just, you know, cure his face, if he looked different, if he looked conventionally handsome, he'd have all of the answers to life's difficult questions. But then he learns that, you know, even if I am handsome, I'm still going to run into difficulties. And he doesn't expect to be jealous of Oswald, played brilliantly by Adam Pearson. It's such a brilliant role for Pearson, because he just, there's this lovely scene halfway through where Edward, posing as this new guy, he has no imagination. He literally renames himself John Guy. So he is auditioning for the role of Edward in this play about his life. And Pearson's character, Oswald, just walks in and it just has this confidence that Edward never had, where he just steals the attention away from Guy. You know, the director falls for him. They want him to replace him in the play. And Guy just becomes obsessed with, you know, trying to get this other Edward character, the way he sees him, out of his life. And he kind of starts to kind of lose his grip on reality. It's a very, very strange film, but an original one. And I think that's what I liked about it.
Yeah, and you know, one has to be careful about talking about these things, but and that we don't talk clumsily about it, and I'm referring to myself primarily here. But I'm assuming then that at no point are cheap jokes being made at this person's facial condition or anything like that.
No, absolutely not. And you're right. You know, the film, it does toy with their expectations, and it lingers in territories and on subjects that other films and that, you know, maybe films, books, and plays would be terrified to venture, because you know, it is having some very difficult conversations, but you never once feel as though Adam Pearson, for instance, who does have this condition in real life, you know, that is not a mask. That is not if, you know, we see Sebastian Stan in effective prosthetics, but this is, you know, Adam Pearson's real life. It's not poking fun whatsoever. It's just asking questions about, you know, the state of happiness and, you know, what kind of, and also going into this territory, John, where what audiences expect from performers when they're playing someone with a condition like what Edward had.
Yeah.
There are these wonderful conversations. It's not solving anything, but there are these wonderful conversations in the film where you have the director and you have audience members saying, should the lead character in a film about someone with maybe a disability, should they actually have that in real life?
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it is poking the bear a little bit, you know, it is starting some interesting conversations. It doesn't end them, you know, that's up for us to go away and have them among ourselves. But I quite like that it did that. There's an awful lot going on in here.
So that sounds like loads to talk about, very funny in places as well. So is this a ringing endorsement, and what are you going to give it stars wise?
It really is. I mean, if it has one flaw, it's that in the final 15 minutes, it sort of slips on a banana skin. It kind of doesn't really know how to end, but I'm willing to overlook that because the performances, the writing, the plotting, all terrific, very, very funny, original, weird, but delightfully so. I think there's award season buzz here, so I will give it a four out of five.
4 out of 5 for A Different Man, which is on general release from this Friday, the 4th of October. And Chris Wasser is giving it 4 stars. He doesn't give them away easy, folks. So this sounds like a good movie. Let's take a quick clip.
What's your name?
Edward.
Do you work for Facebook?
No, but I get this a lot.
Oh, hey, neighbor. People can be cruel, I imagine.
All unhappiness in life comes from not accepting what is. You know who told me that? Lady Gaga.
A clip there from A Different Man, which is in cinemas from this Friday, which Chris Wasser gave 4 stars to. Now, Chris, another interesting sounding movie. I like the title alone. Things Will Be Different. It is about time travel, which can be very confusing for the likes of me. And even though there are lots of time travel movies I enjoy, none of them, with the possible exception of Back to the Future, although that makes no sense whatsoever, a lot of the times they don't hang together. Does this hang together?
Oh, I don't know. I think if you I think this is all, actually the second film of the week with the word different in its title, and this, like the other one, although very, very different, you know, they've got some big ideas at play. I think if you think too much about the plot of Things Will Be Different, your brain might start to leak out of your ears. So
okay, try and tell me what the plot is about without any fluids coming out of your ears.
But it focuses on the sibling Sydney, played by Riley Dandy, and Joseph, played by Adam David Thompson. And from the very first scene where one of them is in a diner with a shotgun and the other walks in also armed, you know that these guys are in trouble. And the details are a little sketchy, but you know that they have probably...
I like it already.
Yeah, there you go. 5 stars straight away. But you know that they've probably robbed the bank because the brother has $5 to $7 million in these 2 duffel bags. So they need a place to lay low for a while. Fortunately, the brother has actually secured a safe house on the edge of town. And not just any safe house, but a safe house with a closet that leads to the past. So the rules, you mentioned time travel thrillers, you know, being very, very tricky and a little bit confusing. This is no different. The rules are messy, but Joseph basically tells his sister that if they walk through this door, if they fix the clocks in the house, if they say a few words, make a phone call, it's all a bit weird, they will be able to travel to the past and hide out in the past for exactly 14 days. Now, it has to be just 14 days as far as the sister is concerned, because she has a life to get back to. She has debts to pay. That's why they need the money. And she also has a daughter to raise. So they need to be back in 14 days. I do not need to tell you, John, that something happens where they won't be able to return in 14 days. And let's just say that outside forces intervene and tell them that they're stuck outside of time and their homecoming will have to wait until they do something for these outside forces.
Okay, well, there's like shades of Narnia there, as well as Back to Future and all that, going into a closet. And they're siblings who clearly have some static between each other and all. So despite the head-scratching nature of all time travel movies, is this successful?
Yeah, I liked it. I think so. I mean, it has, you know, there are a few narrative wobbles there. I think it's probably at its best. In the last 20 minutes, it starts to explain too much. And I was thinking to myself, don't explain anything. You know, look, I'm happy. There's, you know, there's this device where the siblings are able to communicate with someone either in the past or the future. You don't really know. They do so with a tape recorder that goes into a vault, and they'll record a message, put the tape recorder into a vault, close it, then open it, and the returning message will be there. And you're thinking to yourself, how does that even work? I don't care. It's actually effective. It's doing what it's supposed to do. It's making, you know, it's a bit of a head scratcher, and it's quite an effective one. I think I would much rather see a film like this take some really big swings than to kind of, you know, not take any risks at all. And though it is a little bit too loose with its logic, I think what it lacks in clarity, it more than makes up for in confidence and ambition. The performances are nice. You know, it's obviously short on funds, but it's quite economical. You know, it is quite an effective little chamber piece. And also one of the best endings to a time travel film that I've seen for a long time. Think something along the lines of... Loop. You know, you mentioned Narnia there. I suppose anytime anyone goes into a closet and ends up somewhere fantastical, it's going to be a bit Narnia. But actually, something along the think along the lines of Rian Johnson's Looper, and you're halfway there.
Oh, great. Yeah. Okay. So, what are you going to say stars wise for Things Will Be Different?
I think a solid 3 out of 5, and I look forward to seeing what the director Michael Felker does next.
Okay, so that is 3 stars for Things Will Be Different, a time travel movie, which is on general release from this Friday, the 4th of October. Now, Chris, I was talking to Todd Phillips earlier in the show about Joker Folie à Deux. I enjoyed it. I'm sensing you didn't.
No.
He's paused there for dramatic effect.
That's exactly it. Look, I'll say some positives first. I mean, I don't think anyone expected Todd Phillips to make a musical when it came to a Joker sequel. And I quite like the fact that he's done something here that the guys at Marvel would never do. You know, I mean,
as he was saying to me in the interview, you know, he wasn't trying to sell Joker pajamas, certainly not in the first one, and he's certainly not in this one. Like,
no, definitely not. No, they'd be lucky if they sell Joker albums, because it is a musical. And I find it a little bit strange too, the way some of the casting creators are kind of moving away from the dreaded M word. Why, if it's a musical, advertise it like that? Because they shouldn't be worried. It's as though they're worried that all that jazz and all those show tunes, that will kind of, you know, reduce profits. It won't. People are going to go see the film whether it's good or bad. And I really wanted it to be good because I had an awful lot of time for that first film. So yeah, I do like the fact that it does take risks. I do like the sound of a comic book musical. And I also like that Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix said, we're not going to give them the Clown Prince versus Batman. We're not going to go big on the action set pieces. We're going to be edgy and eccentric, and we're going to do something a little bit different. It's one thing to say you're going to do something different. You need to follow it up with some great ideas, you know, with some clever dialogue, with something that brings us into new territory. If you're going to make a sequel, you have to somehow enhance the story a little bit. You need to move forward. You need to.
But did you not think that the fact that it takes place largely as a courtroom drama with a lot of musical numbers and a really strange dysfunctional relationship with Lady Gaga was moving it forward?
I don't think so. No, because the courtroom drama was just stagnant. I just thought it was so... If you had the seeds of a compelling drama there and you had the seeds of a great musical, but they sort of get in the way of one another. And I don't think Phillips ever really kind of commits to either of them. Every time I thought it was starting to go somewhere, a song would come in. And every time I was starting to enjoy a musical performance, we would turn to the drama. And I was a little bit unsure about what was happening in each world. I'm okay with some of the fantasy musical sequences happening, you know, being a fantasy or happening in their heads. But every time the characters actually started to sing to one another in, you know, their real world, supposedly, I was a little bit like, okay, so it's a musical in their life too. I was a bit confused about what was going on there. So I don't think it really works as a musical. I don't think it ever really finds its feet. I think as a drama, it's a bit drawn out. It's incomplete. It's unsure of itself. And the performances too. Joaquin Phoenix, as an actor, unbeatable. And he was sensational in that first film. I just think to see him playing the Joker again, it's like watching a magic trick for the second time. You know, you appreciate the skill and you applaud the effort. You absolutely do. I always will with Joaquin Phoenix. But there's no more surprises. I mean,
but were you not taken by kind of, we learned more about his troubled past and how chilling that could be for him and how dark life might have been in the past and the ghosts that continue to inherit his head and psyche?
Well, we kind of got what we needed to get in that regard in the first film. It felt a little bit like Todd Phillips was taking out these, you know, sketches and drawings that he had from the first one, and he just started shading everything in. And it's like, why? You don't need to do that. You don't need to over-explain. We got that, you know, Arthur Fleck had this, you know, abusive, terrible upbringing by these terrible people. We got all of that the first time around. And to kind of over-explain things, and feel like not everything needs to be filled in. And just even going back to the performances, I love Lady Gaga as an actor and as a musician. And I think she's presented with an impossible task here. I wasn't a fan of her performance. I found it quite flat and uninspired. But I don't think that's really her fault. I think her Harley Quinn, and this is Scott Silver and Todd Phillips' fault, I think her Harley Quinn feels like a little bit of an afterthought. It's just something to kind of, it almost feels like this character and that story is just something for the Joker to do when he's not on trial, and it doesn't really feel complete at all. I will say, though, you could never accuse her of phoning anything in. When it comes to the musical numbers, she triumphs over Phoenix, and that creates another problem because it just highlights that Joaquin Phoenix is not, and I'm saying this as someone who has watched Walk the Line far too many times, but in terms of musical numbers, Joaquin Phoenix is not up to the task there. It's not a strong performance in that regard. And also, not an ounce of chemistry between them. Nothing between them.
No, I thought there was. I'm going to use that cliche, we're agreeing to disagree, or, well, we're just disagreeing. So if you had to give it 2 stars, what would it be? All right, what? I 2 stars. You're giving it 2 stars, I gather.
Which I am giving 2 stars. I will briefly add, John, Brendan Gleeson, who better than a tough-talking Dubliner to put manners on Arthur Fleck? And he is playing such a nasty character here, but he's doing it so well. And I feel a little bit sorry for Gleeson, because I know he came into this film because he loved that first one so much. And I thought that Gleeson deserved a better film there.
I wouldn't feel sorry for him at all. But that is your opinion, Chris, which you are very entitled to, and we appreciate. Chris Wasser gives Joker Folle à Deux 2 stars. I would be edging closer to 4. Chris, thank you for all that.
Nice one, John. Cheers.
Up next, an intriguing new documentary called Call Me Mule, about a man wandering the western states for 30 years with 3 mules. Now you're welcome back to the last part of Screen Time. Now, taking place from the 6th to the 13th of October is Indy Cork, a fantastic film festival. And of the many things happening, one that caught my eye was something called Call Me Mule. It's all about, and it's a documentary, so it's not fictional, John Sears, who refers to himself as Mule. He's been roaming the western United States with his three mules for over 30 years. The 65-year-old and his animals sleep outside, claiming the right to move freely. Bemoaning the loss of open space, urban sprawl and our dependence on the car, Mule advocates a simpler way of life in harmony with nature. While many appreciate his nomadic lifestyle, Mule, John Sears, is not welcomed everywhere. His confrontations with law enforcement have resulted in fines, arrest, and even, as we see in the documentary, and I shouldn't be laughing, institutionalization. His story may be unusual, but it has universal appeal. And as he walks down highways and byways, some of those highways are massive, and I was fearful for his and indeed the safety of his mules. I suppose it celebrates the creativity, courage and resilience to choose such an unusual and extraordinary way of life and defend his place in the world. It was directed by filmmaker John MacDonald, who has flown in to Cork for the very festival I mentioned. And I'm delighted to say from Cork, he joins me now by the wonder of technology. Hello, John. How are you?
Hello, very happy to join you.
So listen, John, it's probably a very obvious place to start, but I have to. How did you come across this John? There's three Johns in the room here, but tell me about John Sears and how you came across him and, I don't know, talked him into or persuaded or offered to follow him around.
Well, it is true. When you decide to do a documentary about someone, imagine what it would be like if someone comes into your life and says, I want to follow you around and film you. It's a big commitment that that person makes. And it was not necessarily easy. But I actually first heard of him when a friend called me several years ago and said, you have to run down to the corner and look eastward and see what's coming. And I go, what are you talking about? And he goes, just go do it. I'm not going to tell you anything more. And I kind of went, well, I don't. He goes, no, it's your next documentary. So I went down, looked east, and I see this guy coming down the sidewalk on this rather busy road with these three pack mules. And he didn't look like John Wayne or, you know, cowboy. He looked like basically a homeless person with the three mules. I tried to talk to him and he just walked right past me. And so I went back to my house, which was a block away, got in my car, drove and got ahead of him, parked and basically blocked his passageway and said, I got to talk to you. And he took the mules around the corner because they were actually eating the vegetation of a dentist's office.
Wow.
Beautiful plants. You know, mules eat everything. And it was after that first meeting that I at least found out where he was going to be spending the night. And I did go back the next morning with my camera and kind of broke the ice with him, had a cup of coffee, and eventually spent 27 months following him.
Wow. It seems to me that his lifestyle now, people are probably more sympathetic to it than maybe they would have been years ago in the 80s or 90s because of the kind of techno age we live in. The idea that he sleeps out under the stars and literally wanders the earth. So I have a sense that there's probably a very sympathetic audience to him and indeed your film now, maybe more than there ever had been before.
Possibly. I'm not sure. I think he does have a very sympathetic audience and people just are always offering their help and telling him he can come and stay at their place. He doesn't work out for him very well to work on an itinerary like that because yeah. He basically travels 10 or 15 miles a day. And when he or the mules are ready to sleep, he just kind of finds the most convenient place and unpacks the mules and rests for the night. And therefore, that's the problem. The freedom to roam means you really need to be able to rest and take care of yourself and your animals in this case, wherever that might be. And as long as you're not interfering with anybody or anything, that should be fine. However, there's lots of rules in America. And you look at some of these signs and There's just a list of 15 rules, and nothing says that you can't be there with mules or whatever.
Mm.
But people kind of don't know how to, people in of the authorities don't quite know how to handle it. And it usually starts with a private citizen concerned about this because they haven't seen it before. So they'll call the police and say, yeah, I'm seeing a man with three mules here. Well, the police have to respond. That's their job. But when they're responding to something that requires animals, then they have to bring out animal control. And then animal control has to inspect the mules and make sure they're not being abused.
Mm.
And it's just, they can hold them up for 2 hours just doing all this. And in most cases, let him go. But it's something he faces almost on a daily basis.
Yeah, and that comes across in the film. And it has to be said, I mean, not that there's an enemy, but he has a lot of brushes with law enforcement. But some of the police are very welcoming to him as well, it has to be said. You know, how he got here is kind of alluded to. And he talks about struggling in school and in young life and being very anxious and a bit of a mess, but it's not spelled out. It's a big philosophical question, but is he happy where he is in life, do you think? Or do you have any sense that he's on the run from anything?
Oh, no, he's really happy. He's exactly in the place he wants to be. And like we kind of allude to in the film, I mean, it's all coming from his voice, by the way.
Yeah.
It's a total observational document.
There's no voiceover.
Told in his own voice, no editorializing or anything along the way. And this is something my daughter, Nina, who cut the film, decided to do when she looked at some early cuts of the film where I had interviews and, you know, all these things that are often in documentaries. She goes, Dad, if you're going to let me cut the film, I'm taking all that, throwing it out, and we're just going to hear from him and his voice. And she combed through all this footage and all these and found all these good recordings from his voice. And so that part about him, he did suffer as a child. He was bullied. He was basically bullied. And he did have some mental issues caused by things that he doesn't go into for great detail. But one of the best therapies you can have, of course, is walking.
Yeah.
Walking is great therapy. Even if a person goes and walks around a block, they feel better. The other thing is having animals in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Animals bring you things that people can't bring.
Yeah. You know, I was in Haight-Ashbury once in San Francisco, and we were recording something for a radio show, and we met this young man who played the violin on the street, and he described himself as a hobo, and he traveled all around California riding rails, and this is only 4 years ago, and I felt there's a yin and a yang to that lifestyle. There may be a freedom to it, but it strikes me there's a sadness about it as well. Now, I'm talking from the position of a middle-aged, middle-class, comfortable male. But I mean, do you see any, I'm guessing you don't see any sadness in John's life where he is now?
Oh, no, not at all. And I mean, he does lead a pretty unique life. I mean, there are people who do these travels with their animals, and usually, like, say we're going to take our horses across the United States, but nobody lives this lifestyle for so many years.
He
makes a distinction between his life and the life of a homeless person. And a lot of homeless people say, well, you know, I'm exactly where I want to be. The world is my home. I'm free to travel. But it's different. It's a lot different. Because it's not like if he had all the money in the world, he would still do what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he is just a totally unique individual. Maybe other people in other parts of the world live that kind of life, but he is the only person, I think, in all of the United States who lives this lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. And tell me this finally, is he still out there as we speak now, walking through the West?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's up in Northern California, last I heard. He actually has his own Facebook page.
Yeah.
And he has his own social media. Well, you know, when I met him, it said on one of the pack boxes, 3mules.com. And you see that in the film. And that's something, he had this website set up by someone.
Mm.
And it just had one paragraph on it that it kind of explained who he is and what he's doing. And I said, why did you get that set up? And he goes, because people kept stopping me along the road when I was trying to hike and ask me what I'm doing. So now they can just go to the website and they get to see that.
Yeah.
And it's expanded much bigger now. I mean, he has things like the mule tracker where you can track to see where he is at different times.
It's a brave new world. And tell me this.
All things that people have done for him along the way.
Yeah. Finally, then, the movie Call Me Mule, which is showing at Indy Cork, it's being showed on the 7th of October. Has John seen it?
I don't think he has seen the film.
Okay.
No, as we were wrapping up, he said, I don't think that's your thing. And I think you've got enough filming done and you've got your film. And I think we better part ways and I'll go on with my life and you go on with yours. And good luck.
Wow. That sounds very in keeping with the man I saw in your movie, which, as I say, is called Call Me Mule. It's being shown as part of the Indy Cork Film Festival, which runs from the 6th to the 13th of October. I've been talking to the film's director, John MacDonald. John, thanks a million.
Thank you, John.
John MacDonald there talking to me about his documentary Call Me Mule, about the very unusual and intriguing life of John Sears, who's quite literally wandering around with three mules all around Western America. And you can that's been shown as part of Indy Cork. And you can find out more about Indy Cork at indycork.com, a great film festival. That's it for this week. I'll just remind you this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Get in touch with me at any stage. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. And you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Have a safe week ahead. And I'll talk to you all next week.